On the panel today, a man who's brought so many Māori stories to our screens, Tainui Stevens, the producer and presenter of acclaimed work on the Māori Battalion, the New Zealand Wars, the movie River Queen. Kia ora, Tainui, piki mai kakamai.
Oh, kia ora, I'm here. Tēnā koe, Jim. Lovely to hear your nil. Tēnā koe, bro.
Thank you, Tainui. And with us, the pilot, beekeeper, teacher of physics, film critic, there is nothing you can't turn his hand to, Steve McCabe.
Good afternoon.
Shortly, the latest on the breaking saga of David Cunliffe's memory, but first, what the panellists have been up to. Home improvements in your case.
Home improvements. My wife and I, Debbie and I, bought a few years ago, we bought a lovely old house. It was a pre-loved house, but the loving had ended quite a long time before we moved in. But it was a lovely old house that we bought. And we've spent the last 4 years, little by little, renovating it. And it's been a wonderful learning experience. I have learned so many skills I never expected to learn. I can polish floors. I can install locks. I can rehang doors. These are never skills I ever thought I'd have before I bought this house. And so last weekend, we spent the weekend building and painting a new fence for the front garden, which has been a wonderful experience. Again, another skill I never expected to
have. Did you teach yourself these skills?
Actually, I have to thank my neighbour David, who is the most amazing teacher of these skills. He's got the patience of a saint, and he spent hours with me showing me how to do things. He helped me install the deck outside our front door. He helped me with the fence. He's done all kinds of stuff, and he's been absolutely wonderful. Other friends, and again, I'm going to thank in particular Eric and Suzanne, who came over and actually helped us install the damn thing over last weekend. Mm-hmm. Spent hours swinging hammers. It's been very, very productive and very, very satisfying.
Congratulations on your new skills.
Oh, thank you very, very much. You never know when they'll come in handy.
Well, Tainui's needed no DIY at all because I think you've been in Bali.
Oh, well, bro, I'm just so not a DIY person. My honey laughs because I have a toolbox that's yellow and she says it has the shiniest tools in any toolbox she's ever seen.
Do they still have price tags on the money shots?
Yes, oh, I get rage rap or rap rage for sure. We've had a wonderful time recently in Bali and I think one of the things I love about Bali, apart from, I guess, the innate spirituality of the people and the food and the juices and the prices of things, is we enjoy the traffic. We just have just the best time hiring a scooter for about $5 a day and just getting in with the flow that is Indonesian traffic. You have to, it's an organic thing. And, I mean, the people that you have to, and the footpaths on the side have little side ramps built into them because if a road is one way, scooters go both ways. They go up over footpaths, they go wherever they need to get to. And if you can actually feel confident enough to get into the groove, it's actually a very safe, secure kind of thing. And I've asked myself, why is this? And one reason I think is that when you look at the families that travel on scooters, you've got whole families, mum, dad, two or three kids, some of the kids are asleep. And I think that in the traffic and all the congestion, people know this. I think they're way more observant than we are over here. They're much more forgiving of things like speed. In fact, the most difficult people to contend with in Balinese traffic, I've found, have been the foreigners.
The tourists.
We're either too tentative or too aggressive. And there are some dickheads out there. But yes, being a part of Balinese traffic is a wonderful thing, actually. Felt very, very safe.
So it wouldn't work here, would it? So the warp. So you need to be in a groove. This is the warp, sort of the warp and weave of Balinese traffic. You need to kind of be there and acclimatise yourself to that, whatever it is.
You do, and I mean, a five road intersection is not for the faint-hearted, and
no.
You just head into it, and everyone's heading into it together, but if you don't hurry, you can see where to go. And I'm just amused in the sense that, you know, people talk about Asian drivers and all those stereotypes come out, but I have encountered the best drivers I've ever come across.
So a lot safer than being in Paris and trying to get around the Arc de Triomphe.
Very much so. Although I do remember once on the motorway in Germany, I mean, one of the things about Germany, a friend of mine who lived there for many years, he says he loves living there because everything works. And I remember I had a rental car, it was an Opel, and there was a light broken on the back, just one rear vision light, but all the fists and the imprecations from the good burghers of Stuttgart at me go tooling down the road with one light out. Yeah, so yeah, driving other countries, it's an interesting thing.
Tainui Stevens, Steve McCabe. The biggest political news story of the day, David Cunliffe's letter on behalf of Dong Hua Liu. And the quick history of this again, Dong Hua Liu is the Chinese businessman granted permanent residency by Damien O'Connor back in 2004. against the advice of officials. He developed some sort of rapport with the Labour Party, and Rick Barker met up with him in China. And that's been in the news in the past few days in connection with the claim that Mr. Liu paid $15,000 for a signed book at a Labour Party fundraising auction in 07. And the Labour Party has no record of that. And there's a claim of another donation via auction. Granted citizenship in 2010 after Maurice Williamson lobbied on his behalf. Again, officials recommended against it. John Key opened his Boulevard Hotel project in Auckland. And a business owned by him gave the National Party $22,000. Mr. Liu charged with assaulting his wife, and Maurice Williamson rang the police to ask about the state of the charges and resigned over that, and the rest is fresh in our memories. Anyway, here is the transcript from the New Zealand Herald of what David Cunliffe told reporters on Tuesday. Do you recall ever meeting Liu? I don't recall ever meeting him, no. Did you have anything to do with the granting of his permanent residency? No, I did not. Did you advocate on his behalf at all? Nope. Were you aware of any advice against granting him permanent residency? Not to my recollection. A file released this afternoon by Immigration New Zealand shows a letter from 03 in which David Cunliffe detailed to immigration officials Mr. Liu's plan to set up an export venture. He asked that he be given a time frame, this is Mr. Liu, for the processing of his application. David Cunliffe, it's been tweeted by reporters this afternoon, contacted his office, presumably quite prior to that Q&A, and was told there wasn't a record of advocacy on behalf of Mr. Liu. He says he has the confidence of caucus. I did not advocate for him, he says. A letter has come to my attention, which is 11 years old. I simply asked how long a processing process would take. So here's the letter. I've been approached by my constituent, Donghua Liu, concerned at the time it's taking to process his investment category application. And then at the end, it would be very helpful to Mr. Liu to be advised of an estimated period of time period in which he could expect a decision on his case. So is that advocacy, do you think, or is it just describing? What would you refer to that as?
Well, that it sounds like a reasonably innocuous kind of letter. I mean, the man's an MP. He's been approached by a constituent. It seems reasonable that he would pass that on. It doesn't, unless there's anything that you've redacted there, Jim. It sounds like he didn't say, come on, guys, this fellow's a mate of mine. You need to sort him out. It sounds like a reasonable passing on of an inquiry.
All right. Tainui, what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, I can have some sympathy for these people, Cunliffe and many civil servants, who process so many applications as a normal part of what they do, and it's quite within reason to think that you would forget the name of someone that you'd assisted in the past. I do think, though, that, you know, given not just this instance, but other instances of select memory, that cronies tend to forget that they've actually spoken to each other. And in the whole thing, and whether it's Mr. Cunliffe or Mr. Jones or whomsoever, I think you just see evidence of an indecent haste to genuflect before sources of bucks. And maybe that's just at the source of it all somehow. I mean, it's not many bucks. I mean, 15K would be parking meter money to some of these people. So, yes, I do have some sympathy for people who have to work through a whole procession of names, but I would not be at all surprised if this was just a forgetfulness as, you know,
but you see,
convenience.
Tony, what you're saying makes absolutely perfect sense if he'd actually said that. If he'd said, look, I get thousands of letters a day from constituents. I work my way through them. It's entirely possible that this chap wrote to me as well. That would be fair enough. But he's said rather unequivocally, nope. And that's not, I don't remember. Yes. It's no, I didn't. Absolutely not. And, you know, one piece of advice my father gave me when I was young repeatedly was always give yourself room to manoeuvre. He doesn't. He's painted himself to a corner. He said, no, unequivocally, I didn't. And in the 21st century, you have to remember that nothing is ever forgotten. And so if he has written this letter, somebody is going to be able to find it. And frankly, he should be having a very quiet word with his staff, because if other people have turned this letter up, his staff should have done first and should have let him know what was going on. Because this guy's name's been in the news for a while, hasn't it?
Indeed. You know, I'm sure he's quietly fuming about all this.
The New Zealand Herald's veteran political reporter John Armstrong talks about David Cunliffe's resignation may be in order, he says. David Cunliffe in deep political trouble. Let's find out from Andrea Vance, the Fairfax political reporter, joining us now, how deep she thinks the trouble is that David Cunliffe's in. Andrea, good afternoon.
Hi. Certainly he's in a great deal of trouble. He's faced up this afternoon and explained that he didn't, in fact, write the letter. Someone in his office did, but nonetheless is admitting that it was a brain fade, his memory failed him, something he's repeatedly accused the Prime Minister of. And that goes to the heart of his problem, really. He has accused national ministers in succession of their dealings with Don Hua Lu. And now he's has found that he's been in the same position himself. So it's quite telling in the press conference this afternoon that he admitted that he has consulted with senior colleagues about whether he has the confidence of his caucus. And certainly resignation is in his mind, and it's certainly the drums are beating around here. People are talking about, is this going to cost him his job?
Well, it's a big call, isn't it? And also a tall order for Labour this close to Election Day, having to consider this sort of matter.
It is, and as I've just pointed out in a comment piece on Stuff this afternoon, the timing of this couldn't be more unfortunate for David Cunliffe, possibly fortunate for National. On Friday, a clause kicks in whereby the caucus has the option of deciding on the future of the leadership, whereby they can get rid of the current leader without taking it to that primary-style leadership contest that they've had, that they previously have had to. So, as I say, the timing for David Cunliffe couldn't be worse.
He's saying that the letter was about immigration processes and merely written on a constituent's behalf and wasn't seeking expedition of an application. But is the issue, as Steve McCabe said, Andrea, more about whether the full story should have been told, or should he have made sure in these circumstances that he told a full story?
Well, he this afternoon has insisted, of course, that he hasn't told a lie. He gave an honest answer. He admits that it's a brain fade. He's not blaming his staff, but therein lies the rub, is that he told on two occasions, Monday and Tuesday, he told reporters that he had not met for this individual and he had not lobbied for him. And he said, he told us this afternoon that he'd sought answers from his office. They told him, no, you haven't met him, you haven't had dealings with him. And so a day later, we find out actually he had done both those things. The problem for Labour is that they're trying to convince the electorate that they're fit to govern, but they can't keep decent records, and they haven't been able to provide a correct answer in this instance.
And from now on, presumably any accusations from Labour about National Party entrancement with rich Chinese people are inevitably going to be regarded as the pot calling the kettle black. That's the danger, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for them to go there without screams and cries from the opposite benches of hypocrisy. And frankly, I mean, if they were going to start down this track, or this cash for access track, accusing National of dirty dealings over donations, then they probably should have sought through their records a little better and really cleared up this individual's history with the party.
So what else is going to come out of this now, do you suspect? Are we going to find out more about the process of who knew about the letter, who wrote the letter, who didn't tell Dave or remind David Cunliffe about it?
Well, possibly. I mean, there'll be the ins and outs. Certainly National are hinting there's lots more to come. There's fevered speculation around here about more revelations. But what I think is more important is actually how his caucus reacts, whether they judge, is this the right time to get rid of him, or is it too risky? Does it look that it's much too it'll create too much instability within the party and within the electorate view if it's time to roll him or not?
Which will depend in part on public reaction as to whether it was just, as he says, an understandable memory lapse a long time ago.
I think the perception is already there, and at this stage with these explanations, really, he's dancing on the head of a pin. Unfortunately, the damage has already been done. Mm.
Andrea Vance, thank you for joining us. 22 minutes past four. Now, think poverty and what and where comes to mind. Soweto, slums of Calcutta, Mali. Now we can add pockets of New Zealand, it's claimed, and children living in similar parlous circumstances. Professor Jonathan Boston, who will join us, is the co-author of Child Poverty in New Zealand, along with his wife, Dr. Mary Hutchison, a book launched last night, and we'll talk to him shortly. And he says India has about half of the world's poorest children, but there are children in New Zealand living in circumstances not much different from those in the slums of Delhi. They are in houses that don't have heating, in caravans that don't have running water, in families that simply don't have enough food of the right kind every day. And he says even in India, poverty's relative, because most slum children go to school, health services are available, a high proportion of adults are working, albeit for low wages. And it's not a pretty comparison. Do you think it's a fair one? We'll find out more from Jonathan himself, but do you think it's a fair one the way he explains it?
I think it depends on exactly how we're defining poverty, because, you know, as we've said, wages are low in India, but then the cost of living in India is proportionately lower as well. If you are fed, clothed and housed, then it's hard to make a case for you being fundamentally poor. If you live in housing which is not adequate to the climate you live in, if you don't have food security, then you're approaching poverty. And if that's what we're talking about in New Zealand, then I'd say that, yes, there is widespread poverty among children in this country, especially in Auckland.
We talked not so long ago with Dr. Elizabeth Craig from Otago University, who firmly opined, from all the longitudinal research being done down there, that 17%, I think was the figure, of children were cold in their homes or go without shoes or are hungry. And some are saying, look, that's not poverty, it's hardship. It's not nice, but it's not true poverty. But that depends on the definition, doesn't
it? Oh, I think it's a bit specious, that kind of thinking. I mean, New Zealand is a cold country, and there are pockets of the country beyond Auckland where people do suffer through a lack of heating. And it doesn't take too much to realise that whether it's unemployment causing poverty or the things that flow on from poverty, lack of education, lack of health, attention, it's a fact in this country. And, you know, I think this report is welcome, if only to make ourselves more aware of that. Now, these things are happening in New Zealand.
Professor Jonathan Boston, the co-author of the book Child Poverty in New Zealand, is kindly joining us now. Jonathan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
It has been opined at the highest level for a long time in New Zealand that, you know, we don't have real poverty. How can you clarify the criteria for deprivation, what you think it consists of?
All right. Well, there's a lot of debate about this, and there is no kind of global agreement on exactly how we should define poverty. But there are some, I think, important distinctions and some relevant criteria. So in the international literature, a distinction is sometimes made between abject poverty and relative poverty. Abject poverty is sometimes defined as people living on less than $1.25 US per day. And there's around, in India, for example, 40% of the population living below that threshold. Some people see abject poverty as circumstances where people basically cannot be expected to survive biologically in the long run. So in other words, essentially they're starving. Now, if abject poverty is at sort of that end of the spectrum, then sort of all other poverty is relative, and it's on quite a long continuum from people who are kind of just adequately fed, if you like, so they can survive, through to people who are at the border between being in poverty and simply not being well off. And where do we draw that boundary? Well, in the international literature, it's typically done on considerations of material deprivation. So what we do is we survey the population and we ask people, what do we think are some of the essential things you need in this particular society? So, you know, it might be a raincoat, a sturdy pair of shoes, having your own bed, being able to heat your home, having two reasonable meals a day, et cetera, et cetera. And then you say, all right, how many people are missing out on those essentials? And you do a survey, and you get the data, and then you say, okay, you've got these sort of, you know, 12 or 20 or 30 essential items. We're going to put a cut point somewhere. If you're missing out, say, on 3 of 12 items, then you're experiencing relative poverty.
Okay, and we understand those criteria, and they seem reasonable. Is there a difference, though, between the poor of India and the poor of New Zealand?
Oh, look, in general terms, the poor of India are much, much poorer than the poor of New Zealand. But the point I was making in response to a question last night in Auckland, which then got reported in the Herald, was that at the top end of the slums in Delhi, which my wife and I spent several weeks in at the end of last year, you know, there are people living in houses which are permanent materials. They have doors and locks. They've got electricity. Some of them even have pardon me, some of them even have air conditioning. They have television. Some of them have, you know, satellite dishes, etc. The older children have cell phones, etc., etc. You know, some of those children are not much different in their circumstances of living to some of our poorest children. You know, some of our poorest children are in homes which don't have any form of heating. Some of them don't even have electricity. In 2011, 50,000 families had their electricity cut off because they couldn't pay the bills.
It's interesting what you say about the televisions, because this is an accusation levelled against the poor of New Zealand, isn't it, perennially, that,
sure.
that you know, these people can afford Sky TV. And so that isn't actually a criterion of poverty or not at all.
Well, I think, you know, one of the critical things we have to think about for a society like New Zealand is, you know, where should we, given that we're a relatively affluent society by international standards, where should we draw this line between what we regard as being sort of unacceptable and acceptable? What is adequate and what is inadequate? And in our kind of society, you know, we obviously think that children should be able to have birthday parties and have friends around. We think that children should be able to participate in after-school activities, even if they cost a bit of money. We think that people should be able to have a holiday, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the children in the poorest slums of Delhi, I mean, those things are out of the question. But in our kind of society, we think they really are important if people are going to be included in society and have a sense of belonging. And if that is important, then we need to ensure that we arrange our policy framework so that, you know, the overwhelming majority of children can enjoy those sorts of things.
The Children's Commissioner, Dr. Russell Wills, says New Zealand's living standards will drop unless it invests more in children. We've heard that for a while, and there have been numerous initiatives of the type that I think he means. Mm. And I wonder, the penny does seem to have dropped, but what do you think of the progress we're making?
Well, if you look at the various measures of poverty that we have, I'm afraid we're not making much progress at all. On income-based measures, our child poverty rates are now double what they were 30 years ago. And in terms of material deprivation, on some of the measures we have, our children are deprived at the rate of 3 to 6 times that of the elderly, those 65 plus. So, and moreover, things are not getting better. So we have to, I think, take a very hard look as a society at how our poorest children are managing or not managing, and we need to think very carefully, as my colleague Simon Chappell and I have done in our book, we need to think very carefully about how we can address the challenges we face and do that in an evidence-based, reasoned, careful, thoughtful way. Not just, as some people say, throw money at the problem, but think very carefully about the kinds of interventions that are going to make a cost-effective difference.
I would like to point out that I do find this issue of pointing out that there are TVs in the homes is a rather grubby way of diverting the attention away from the real issue, which is about child poverty here. The children who have the TVs in their homes aren't necessarily making the choice to have those TVs there. And if they... In the cases, the hypothetical cases we're talking about, parents have chosen to spend money on this mythical television instead of food for the children. But it's not the children's fault. The children are still the ones going hungry. And so the children are, almost literally, having the sins of the father visited upon them by being left in poverty. And then society, in the form of the government of the day, is not doing enough to address that need. When we know that there are children in poverty, I teach at a very, very low decile school in South Auckland, where we have a breakfast club for our children. And that breakfast club is funded by a local charity, not by the government, but by the local charity. And I would like to see something else other than local charities providing food for children who are otherwise coming to school on an empty stomach and therefore not in a fit state to learn.
Yes, well, just interesting, in Delhi, I hadn't realised this before we went, but the Indian government provides food to virtually all primary school children in India every day at school. That's around 130 million children in India are being fed by the government every day. And indeed, actually, most governments around the world provide food in schools for most of their primary school children. I hadn't been aware of that until fairly recently. It's interesting that, you know, this is something in which New Zealand is rather different. I mean, to be honest, I think we should be providing enough resources through social assistance, tax credits, through obviously providing people with work and encouraging people into good forms of stable employment. We should be ensuring that children don't need to be provided with food at school. But in the current circumstances, I don't think we have any choice but to address that challenge.
All right, Jonathan, thank you for joining us. Professor Jonathan Boston, Child Poverty in New Zealand is the book, just out, 27 minutes to 5. Steve McCabe, Tainui Stevens on the panel, back with them shortly. Hewitt has the news headlines.